This is exactly right.
Forgive me for interrupting. I'm Bridger Weiniger, host of I Said No Gifts on Exactly Right. Each week, I invite my favorite people in comedy over to chat, and they always bring a gift. We're coming up on our 200th episode, and every episode is a gem. I have welcomed all kinds of great guests, including Cola Scola, Bowen Yang, Robbie Hoffman. It goes on and on and on. And you don't want to miss the 200th episode with the great Maria Bamford. What does she bring me? Find out April 25th. New episodes every Thursday. Follow I Said No Gifts wherever you get your podcasts.
The disease began in various ways, but commonly with chills and heats, pressure and pain in the head, soreness of throat and hoarseness, some cough, sickness of the stomach, frequent vomiting, and purging. These symptoms occurred more frequently in children and were then very severe. In adults, they were less emphatically expressed. Commonly on the uvula, tonsils, velum palatinum, and back part of the pharynx, several whitish or ash-colored spots appeared scattered up and down, which oftentimes increased very fast, soon covering one or both of the tonsils. These eventually proved to be the sloughs of superficial ulcers. The tongue at this time, though only white and moist at the top, was very foul at the root and covered with a thick, yellowish or brown coat. The breath also now began to be very nauseous. The offensive smell increased hourly and in some instances became quite intolerable, even to the patients themselves. By the second or third day, the sloughs were much enlarged and of a darker color, and the surrounding parts tended much more to a livid hue. The breathing became more difficult, with a kind of rattling stertor, as if the patient was actually strangling, the voice being exceedingly hoarse and hollow. Yeah, it's pretty intense. So, what does that sound like to you?
Sounds like diphtheria.
That's right. The topic of today's episode.
All right.
Hi, I'm Erin Welsh.
And I'm Erin Ullman Updike.
And you are listening to This Podcast Will Kill You. Diphtheria edition.
Yep.
So,
I'm really excited.
I am really thrilled.
You've been talking about this one for a while now.
I know. And there's also, there's been something in my part that I have been dying to tell you about. And I've been keeping it secret and...
keeping it safe?
Keeping it secret, keeping it safe.
Well, I can't wait to hear it.
Good. I guess, though, that we should start first with our
quarantinis.
So, what do we have to drink tonight?
Tonight, we're drinking the Strangling Angel.
Oh, that sounds menacing.
It's a little bit.
But it's also quite delicious.
It's actually quite good. It's a kind of a variation on a penicillin, which who knew that was a real cocktail?
I know, maybe we should have. We do now.
We do. It's got, what, whiskey,
either
lemon juice.
Bourbon or rye.
And lemon juice.
Ginger liqueur.
And a little maple syrup. Mm-hmm. And in addition to our quarantinis this episode, we'll also be making, what are we calling them? Placeboritos?
Yeah.
Placeboritas? Guys, come up with a better name for that. And we'll be posting the full recipe for the quarantinis and the placeboritos. We'll be posting those non-alcoholic versions online as well.
Yeah.
On all of our social media channels, so you guys can find those and drink along with us.
Yeah. So.
So.
Now that that's out of the way.
Let's get started. So diphtheria is caused by a bacterium known as Corynebacterium diphtheriae. And I did, in fact, look up how to pronounce that.
Oh, good.
That's like the first time for me ever.
Well, it's a strange spelling.
Yeah, I looked at it and I was like, I'm going to look this one up. Corynebacterium diphtheriae, it's a gram-positive rod, so it's shaped like a little tube, not a ball
like
or anything.
Like a little good and plenty?
Yeah, good and plenty. That's a great one, actually. And one thing that's interesting about this disease is that the disease that we associate with diphtheria is not caused by the bacterium itself. It's caused by a toxin. And this toxin is produced by a virus, a bacteriophage that actually infects the bacterium.
What?
Yeah. So a lot of the toxins, we talked about toxins in the MRSA episode. Uh-huh. A lot of the toxins that bacteria, that quote unquote bacteria produce are actually produced by viruses.
So it's this little mutualism?
I guess commensalism? Yeah,
maybe?
Commensalism. I haven't really seen, I mean, presumably, at least in the case of humans, which are the pretty much only reservoir for diphtheria, you might be getting more sick. So I guess if that's beneficial, then it, you could call it a mutualism. But I don't know if that actually, like, I don't know that the bacteria survives any better with this bacteriophage or not.
Okay.
So maybe that's, someone else who knows can tell us.
That's really interesting, though.
Yeah. So it's not the bacterium itself. So there are strains out there that are what are called non-toxigenic strains. Those can still infect you. They can still cause some disease, but they generally don't cause as severe of disease and not the type of disease that we might associate with diphtheria.
Okay.
So, ready?
Uh-huh.
So, diphtheria, and from now on, whenever I talk about it, we'll just assume that it's a toxigenic strain of the bacterium. So it's making toxin, it's trying to kill you.
Gotcha.
It's transmitted via aerosols, so coughing, spitting, sneezing, etc.
Lovely.
The incubation period is 2 to 5 days. So if I cough on you, 2 to 5 days later, you're going to be getting sick, most likely. And historically, not to step on your toes or anything.
No worries. My toes are safe.
But historically, diphtheria has been a disease of childhood, very specifically of childhood, meaning babies didn't usually get it and adults didn't usually get it. Do you have a guess as to why?
I'm guessing that in babies, it would have to do with maternal antibodies from breast milk.
Boom, nailed it.
And adults, I would assume that most of the adults would have had been asymptomatic and been exposed to it and then developed immunity?
Or just had it and survived it. Yeah exactly. Yeah. So they definitely were exposed and either got the infection and survived it, or they were asymptomatic carriers, which is very common in diphtheria, meaning just because someone looks healthy doesn't mean they are.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. So let's get into what actually happens when you get infected.
Okay.
So the first place that diphtheria tends to colonize is your nasopharynx. So that means your nose and your throat.
Okay.
It is possible to only infect your nasal passages, in which case the disease that it causes is more like the common cold. It's not as severe. You get a lot of bloody mucus and pus coming out of your nose.
God.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. But it's less common. So more commonly, it's actually going to kind of go straight to the back of your throat. And that's its sort of favorite spot to infect. So the progression of the disease I saw described as insidious.
Yeah.
Which is not a good.
No.
You don't want something in your body to be
a negative connotation to that word,
pretty,
I think.
Yeah. Pretty negative. So here's how it begins. You start with a fever. But not like a crazy high fever. So maybe not one that makes you go, I need to get to the doctor, right? Okay. You're running like 100, maybe 101 max. So you're feeling crappy. You're feeling tired, maybe weak. You've got just generally like malaise. You're like, God, I'm coming down with something. Maybe it's the flu. I don't know. And then your throat, like it really hurts. It hurts pretty bad. So then because you're feeling crappy and your throat hurts, you've got anorexia, right? You don't want to eat anything. You don't want to swallow and you just feel bad.
So anorexia is just means not wanting to eat anything?
Yeah, exactly. It means not eating. And so you're like, wow, maybe it's strep throat. Maybe that is that what I've got? I don't know. But then within 2 to 3 days, you're not getting better. And at the back of your throat, you'll see this thing. And it starts out white, just sort of attached to like the roof of your mouth and like back near your tonsils. And then it gets bigger.
I don't like this.
It just keeps getting bigger. And it starts out white, but as it grows to cover your entire soft palate, it can turn green.
Oh my.
Or gray or black.
God, black?
Yeah. And it's not really pus, because pus, you can kind of spit that out, right? Like mucus. You could sort of put your finger back there and scrape it off.
Oh, ugh.
You can't do that with this because it's stuck on. And if you try, like if you really, really try in there, you're just going to cause yourself to bleed a lot because it's stuck on there. And at this point, it might be getting kind of hard for you to breathe. So if you finally were to go to the doctor and they put a stethoscope up to you, they'd hear a sound something like this. Was that good?
Oh my God. I am feeling like the need to breathe very deeply. I'm feeling very stressed right
now.
Yeah,
Erin's, I've made her very anxious.
I am highly anxious.
So that sound that I mimicked, I'm pretty proud of myself for that. I practiced.
It was excellent.
Thank you. It's called stridor. It's not a good sign. It's a very, very bad sign. So at this point, if you've progressed this far, you have two fates. Either you recover somehow or you die. It's pretty much a 50-50 chance. The end. Just kidding.
I'm just letting this sink in because yeah. I have read, obviously, like it's come across my research about sort of the membrane and yeah. the dying, but it's
When you hear the whole thing
and you just imagine this. Well, first of all, I'm going to be terrified for every time I get a cold from here on out. I'm going to be constantly checking the back of my throat
for
little diphtheria
patches. You don't need
to
do that. You've been vaccinated, Erin.
Some of us are just nervous by nature.
Yeah.
Not naughty by nature.
So this thing that's on the back of your throat is called a pseudomembrane. I don't know why they call it that, but that's what they call it. It seems like a pretty real membrane and not a pseudo one, but that's what they're calling it. And basically what happens, and one of the very common ways that you end up dying from diphtheria, is that this thing grows so large and then your surrounding lymph nodes will also swell up that basically your airway is blocked off and you suffocate.
Oh my gosh.
Now, that's not the only way that you can die from diphtheria.
Perfect. Love it.
But before we talk about the other ways that you can die, we'll take a step back and let's talk about what's actually going on inside your body.
Okay, good.
Why are these specific symptoms happening? So like I said, the primary thing that's actually causing this disease is a toxin, diphtheria toxin, not the bacterium itself. So what happens is this toxin is released from the bacterium, made by the bacteriophage inside, released from the bacterium into your body. It enters your cells, so it can actually attach to certain receptors on your cell and get inside of your cell. And once it's in your cells of like the epithelium of your throat, right, it basically inhibits protein synthesis. One of the main things that cells do is make protein. If your cells cannot make protein, they will die.
Yeah. So inhibiting that seems pretty bad.
It's not good. Mm-hmm. So it basically causes cell death. Mm-hmm. So this toxin gets into your cells, stops them from doing their job, and then results in their death. The pseudomembrane that you're actually seeing on the back of somebody's throat is a direct result of this toxin. It's made up of a whole bunch of dead cells that have been infected by this toxin and then killed. And then what happens is, because the bacteria are also there, right? So there are colonies of bacteria. You've got macrophages and neutrophils, which are white blood cells that are coming in to try and eat the bacteria and also clean up after all these dead cells that are now in the back of your throat. Mm. And when there's dead cells, what they do is they lay down this stuff called fibrin, which is like scar tissue.
Oh.
And so that's why it's adherent to the back of your throat. It's not like when you get sick with another, like strep throat, for example, and you might have a bunch of mucus. That mucus is also just white blood cells and bacteria. The difference here is that because you have a bunch of cell death, you have fibrin being laid down, and that's everything is attached still to your healthy living tissue.
That makes sense and is also that much more horrifying.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because there's no just like, oh, let me just hack cough really hard and hack this thing up.
Right.
You can't hack it up.
And it suffocates you. I feel claustrophobic.
I can tell. It's a small room. But like I said, asphyxiation is not the only way that you can die.
Cool.
So the toxin is released into your bloodstream and your nasopharynx, especially the back of your throat, is just rife with blood supply, which means that this toxin can make it into your blood supply and then it can go to the rest of your body.
Cool.
It can travel to your heart, where it will do the same thing that it does in the back of your throat. So it's going to infect your heart cells, cause cell death, and then fibrosis or scarring. And what happens when you have scarring on the muscles of your heart is the conductance, the electrical activity that controls your heart, is impaired. So you've got a bunch of scars from everywhere where you've got dead cells because this toxin killed your cells. And now your heart can't send impulses, so it can't pump correctly. So you end up with arrhythmias. Your heart's not beating in sync with itself. So you can die because your heart stops beating correctly. You can also die. There's more.
You can just, your heart will just stop beating.
Yeah, you go into like a tachycardia or an arrhythmia where your heart is not beating correctly. Like maybe you're going to have atrial fibrillation, which means the top part of your heart is say what my hands are doing because I can't. What do you call this? Fibrillation. I don't know.
I mean, that looked like jellyfish tendrils.
Okay, so it's kind of like that. Like, like instead of being like dunk 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 dunk, your heart's like
it's fluttering.
Yeah, exactly. So that can happen, and that'll kill you, right? Because if your heart's not dunk dunking, it's not pushing blood out. That's what dunk dunk is, right? You also could just become paralyzed.
Cool, great.
Because it can infect your nervous tissue, and if it infects your nerve cells, and then your nerve cells die, then you can't transmit electricity. So it's pretty gnarly. You also can get cutaneous diphtheria, which is basically a giant ulcer on your skin. It's pretty gnarly looking. We should post a picture, but I don't know if we should post a picture.
Maybe we can do like a click to see graphic content.
Yeah, because it's pretty gross.
Now, is that again with the fibrin?
No, it's actually usually a non-toxigenic strain that infects your arms.
Interesting.
And, well, not just arms, but your skin. Yeah. Not exactly sure why, but I have some good news because it looks like you could use it.
Yeah, I'm very tense right now. Yeah. My arms are folded.
She's very walled off.
I feel like my heart is arrhythmic right now.
Untreated, I guess I have a little more bad and then we'll get to the good. Untreated, the mortality rate is up to 50%. So about half of people who get infected and do not have any treatment will die from diphtheria.
High.
It's pretty high. Treated, so we do have a treatment. Treated, the mortality is between 5 and 10%, which is still kind of high.
It's very high.
And in young children, it's actually as high as 20%. And the thing that's really sad is this case fatality rate has not improved over the last 50 years. So we're not any better at treating it now than we were in the 1940s and 50s.
That's scary.
Yeah. But do you want to know how we treat it? It's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's two things that you have to do. The first is give an antitoxin.
Mm-hmm.
You do that to actually treat the symptoms. The thing about this treatment, the antitoxin, is that it only works on toxin that is not already bound to your cells.
Oh.
So you have to be treated very, very early in the course of disease because any cells that are already infected with the toxin are screwed.
Okay.
And then on top of that, you also treat with an antibiotic, and that's both to kill the bacterium itself so it stops making more and to protect those around you. So to make sure that you don't spread this disease to anybody else.
Gotcha.
And the best news is that there is a vaccine. But we'll talk more about that later.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, how did we get here?
Excellent question. diphtheria. Where to begin? Before I started researching this, the word diphtheria didn't really mean much to me on its own, right? It was more just like part of a vaccine lumped in with other diseases that you don't really hear much about anymore, except more recently with the whole anti-vaccine movement, mm-hmm. which I'm sure we'll get into a bit later. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, but as I read more about the history of this disease, I found that the mention of diphtheria in a village or a city could cause a huge panic.
Whoa.
And it was, yeah, it was one of the most feared diseases in pre-vaccine times for a few reasons. One, it attacked children primarily. So it causes horrible, slow, suffocating death that you just talked about.
Yeah.
Which just sounds so awful.
Yeah, you just like watch your kid suffocate.
Yeah.
Like,
I cannot imagine. Yeah.
It's pretty bad.
And also, too, it would show up suddenly and tear through an entire town or village and nothing seemed to stop it. So let's just check off the etymology of this disease before going into any more of its gory historical details. Diphtheria didn't get its name until 1826.
Whoa, that seems super late.
Yeah. And so in this year, a French pathologist named Pierre Bretonneau came up with diphtherite, or something like that, which is from the Greek root diphthera, meaning leather.
Mm.
Which is, of course, what that tough membrane in the throat resembled. Leather.
Grody. It's like a football.
Yeah, and apparently it smelled really bad, according to the firsthand account.
Okay, I really think that was just poor hygiene.
I saw every, like, there were so many firsthand accounts that I read that were like, it smelled disgusting. I mean,
it does make sense because it's just like a bunch of dead stuff in the back of your throat. Yeah. But like some of that description in the firsthand account was like, its tongue was brown. I'm like, bro, that's you, man.
Okay, well... Fair enough. But it was one of the, when in reading some of this, it seemed like there was a characteristic diphtheria smell.
Smell.
Yeah. But the naming itself was really important in the history of diphtheria because before this, outbreaks of sore throat were called by a bunch of different names, which made tracking and monitoring outbreaks difficult, not to mention developing any kind of treatment that was reliable or consistent.
Right.
Okay. So the name didn't come about until the 19th century, but this wasn't a new name given to a new disease. This disease has really characteristic signs like extreme sore throat, leathery membrane. So you would think that tracing the history of diphtheria would be somewhat easy, at least compared to diseases like staph, which was much more...
Right. It's like everywhere and everything, yeah. And causes so many different types of disease.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it actually doesn't have that much of a history before the 1700s.
What?
Yeah, at least that I found. And I could be wrong and I could be looking in the wrong places, but there were some mentions. In the 5th century BCE, Hippocrates writes about a disease that sounds an awful lot like diphtheria. And there's another mention a few hundred years later by Aretaeus, the Cappadocian, in which he describes ulcers in the throat and warns that, quote, if it spreads to the thorax by the windpipe, it occasions death by suffocation within the space of a day.
Yep.
And that, quote, children until puberty especially suffer.
Yep.
So
that does sound a lot like diphtheria.
Probably. Yeah. And that's really more or less the last mention of the disease until the late 1500s and early 1600s.
Weird.
And that's when there was a series of epidemics of sore throats resulting in suffocation that swept through Spain and parts of the New World. This epidemic was referred to as El Año de los Garrotillos, essentially meaning the Year of Strangulations. That was one translation I found for it.
I got chills when you said that.
It sounds terrifying.
A Year of Strangulation.
Yeah. But it remains a bit of a mystery as to why there's no mention of this disease for over 1,000 years. And so I was starting to wonder, well, are we just missing historical accounts? Or did it not really act as an epidemic disease for all that time? Or were the ancient descriptions of the disease actually something else that just happened to resemble diphtheria?
Yeah.
I couldn't really find a whole lot of information on that, on this missing puzzle piece. But I did see somewhere that the bacterium is thought to have come from domestic herbivores, which means it probably has ancient origins.
Right.
Maybe the incorporation of the bacteriophage was more recent, and then the toxin was more recent, but I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. And the thing is, it's like humans, from what I read, are the only reservoir. So these aren't, it's not like currently a zoonotic disease.
Right. So that would further point to an ancient origin.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
Weird.
In any case, diphtheria emerged with a vengeance in 1735 when outbreaks of the illness occurred in New England, Great Britain, France, and the West Indies. People called it throat distemper. And sufferers either died from suffocation by the thick grayish membrane covering their throat.
She's going to say that like 100 more times.
This is the most horrible thing to me. I don't know why. Or if they survived that, they could just drop dead a week or two later.
Yep.
As we've heard.
Arrhythmia.
So, cool, 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 cool. Love it. This outbreak disproportionately affected children, and some families lost all of their kids. Like, entire families, just kids all gone.
I know it is quite infectious. Mm-hmm. And so it does make sense that if you've got a bunch of kids, it's going to go like chickenpox from one to the next, and then boom, boom, boom.
Awful. In Kingston, New Hampshire, a third of all children in this town died from the disease.
Whoa.
A third of all the children. And the state itself lost 5% of its entire population.
So that's really crazy, because that means it's not just like always there. It's like coming into these communities, wiping them out, and then moving on.
Exactly.
Because if otherwise, you would just have like low levels of death all the time.
Right.
Weird.
It's,
I never knew that.
It's an epidemic disease. It's not an endemic.
So then it's even weirder that there's not more accounts of it.
Yes.
What?
I know.
Oh.
Sounds like, yeah. Yeah. It's bizarre.
That is super bizarre.
Obviously, with such a huge loss of life comes people seeking answers, or at least where they can point fingers. And many Puritan ministers said that the people had brought it on themselves by straying too far from the religious path, which I'm sure is exactly what they needed to hear as they have lost their entire children.
Oh, God. It's your own fault, mothers.
Right.
God. The wanton mother.
The wanton mother. Ridiculous. Anyway, so after this first big diphtheria epidemic in 1735, outbreaks showed up every 25 years or so.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it slowly shifted from this epidemic rural disease to a more endemic cosmopolitan disease by the mid-1800s. And it seemed to increase in virulence the entire time.
Yeah.
It was during these outbreaks in the 1800s that diphtheria got its name. The Strangling Angel, which is the name of our quarantine, if you remember. In an outbreak in New York City in 1857, the case fatality rate was 42%, which is, I mean, as we know, that's just what you said, but that's still so high.
Yeah, I mean, that's
almost bubonic plague level.
And it's children, right?
Children.
So you've got a schoolhouse with 100 kids in it. They're all going to get infected, right? Mm-hmm. Like, realistically, 42 of them are going to die.
Yeah.
42. You now have 58 kids in your class.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right.
Thank you.
Congrats.
That's what?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And no amount of therapy or supportive treatment could save the lives of those suffering. And so they died this slow, terrible death.
God.
So physicians deeply feared diphtheria, because they felt pretty much helpless against it.
Yeah.
And even more helpless than the parents, because the parents would take their children to them expecting this person to try to make things better. And no. So it was the parents' absolute nightmare to watch their child suffering so horribly. And for this reason, diphtheria played a prominent role in the development of germ theory in the 1800s.
Our fave.
Oh, yes. All right. So it's the mid-1800s.
Okay.
Let's take a minute to consider some of the prevailing thoughts on what caused disease.
Your bad sexual habits. Okay, wait, that's actually true. My bad. I'm sorry. Let me try that again. Not praying enough.
Actually, I don't really have that in here. Oh. I think by that time it was not so. It wasn't so much about the morality.
Oh, okay. Bad air.
Bad air. Yes, absolutely. So miasma, that kind of thinking, which if you remember from Jon Snow and the cholera, Broad Street cholera outbreak.
Episode 4, if you haven't listened to it.
Yes. That was all thought to be miasma. So, and then there's also humorism or humoralism,
right,
which we've talked about during tuberculosis.
Episode 9.
Mm-hmm. And then there's germ theory.
Yes.
So the idea that many diseases are caused by microorganisms. So this idea was around, but not necessarily widely accepted quite yet, because humorism was still kind of this the prevailing thought. But it pretty quickly fell out of favor as formal medical research focused on specific tissues or cells as indicators of disease. Importantly, they started asking whether if a specific tissue or organ was inflamed, there could be multiple causes for the same symptom. For instance, diphtheria, scarlet fever, and strep throat all result in inflammation of your throat. Does that mean that they are one disease or many? So this is a big shift in the way that people thought about disease.
Yeah.
So the answer might be obvious to us now.
Yeah.
Of course, these are different diseases. They have different symptomology, blah, blah, blah. But back then, before germ theory had taken hold, this wasn't straightforward. And the concept of multiple causes for the same disease symptoms was really huge. And it partially paved the way for germ theory, especially the one germ, one disease concept. With diphtheria, one thing seemed certain. It was contagious. If it showed up at a school, in one kid, it was only a matter of time before the entire class, as we illustrated, was sick at home or in the hospital or dead.
Yeah.
Now that we knew it was contagious, it was like, okay, well, we need to know which microbe caused the disease, which was difficult to do because the mouth and throat normally contains this really diverse array of microbes. So being able to say that one specific microbe was the cause of a disease wasn't simple. But there was at least a jumping off point, the membrane. By the late 1800s, this dude named Klebs found two types of microbes in the membrane.
Klebs like Klebsiella?
It might be.
Oh, how exciting.
But he didn't know which bacterium was responsible. So that question was solved a few years later in 1884 by a dude named Friedrich Loeffler.
Oh.
He also discovered that the bacillus was only found in the membrane and didn't invade deeper into the body.
Mm.
But diphtheria also causes effects in a more distant parts of your body, so he figured that the distant effects of disease could be caused by a toxin.
Wow, what a smart guy.
Right? We had the causative agent. But there was still the mystery of why an outbreak of diphtheria would suddenly show up without any warning and sweep through a village or school. Where did it come from?
Yeah.
Well, a couple of years after the causative agent of diphtheria was identified, there was an epidemiological survey of children in Berlin that showed that 5% of healthy children carry the bacterium in their throats. So this was the first evidence that carriers of the disease existed. And this was a big deal because it helped to explain the mystery of these sudden outbreaks, and it also led to forced quarantine for people who were suspected to be carriers.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, people were held for months in isolated hospital units. There were quarantine stickers or plaques to put on people's houses if there was an outbreak of diphtheria in a certain house. Yeah. Soon after the discovery of diphtheria carriers, Pierre Paul Emile Roux, who was Loeffler's assistant, found the diphtheria toxin by showing that if you passed bits of diphtheria secretions, like from the membrane, through a superfine filter that would keep the bacteria out and other cells, and then injected the filtrate into an animal, you could cause diphtheria-like symptoms in the animal.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, not cool for the animal, but...
But it's kind of like, boom, toxin.
Yeah.
Got it. Proof in hand. When a couple other microbiologists named Emil von Behring and Shibasa Buro Kitasato heard about the discovery of the diphtheria toxin, they were like, we know what to do with this information. Because if we can fight the toxin, we can fight the disease. So they began working towards developing the diphtheria antitoxin, which was first used in the 1890s.
Wow.
Yeah. And for this research, von Behring was awarded the first Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1901.
What?
Yeah.
For diphtheria antitoxin?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
Diphtheria was a big deal.
Yeah, I definitely had no idea that it was such a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, it was, it's just the D in Tdap.
Exactly.
That's all it was to me.
Yeah, it was a lot more, and it really left a mark. And it's kind of funny because it seems like so much of diphtheria's history is squeezed into just a few decades. It was only in the 1850s that the disease became endemic in cities, and within 50 years, the bacterium had been identified, its toxin isolated, and a moderately effective treatment produced.
Wow.
Boom, boom, boom. But diphtheria was in no way defeated or forgotten. It was still one of the illnesses that most terrified parents and racked up a hefty death toll. Even with the advent of antitoxin, it remained the number one killer of children in some countries, killing thousands of children every year. For instance, in the U.S., 13,000 to 15,000 children died every year from diphtheria. This is in the early 1900s.
Oh my God.
And in January 1925, it would take the front page of so many newspapers in a dramatic race against time.
Race against time?
Okay. Let's take a quick trip to Nome, Alaska.
Yes.
Do you know where this is going?
No.
Okay, great. In 1924, Nome is still a baby city. It had been founded only 27 years earlier by a few gold prospectors, which then led the way for hundreds more to rush to this extremely remote part of Alaska, which was still just a U.S. territory and not a state. Nome is just a couple of degrees south of the Arctic Circle and extremely far west on the Seward Peninsula. And we'll post a map. In 1924, it was one of the most remote cities on Earth. Nome was closer to Siberia than it was to any other major town in Alaska.
Whoa.
Its population had shrunk from around 20,000 during the peak of the gold rush to around 1,500 brave or crazy people that made it their home in 1924.
Wow.
For most of every year, from around October or November to July, Nome was more or less shut off from the rest of the world. The port was inaccessible due to freezing water. No train reached that far west, and planes hadn't yet been designed to withstand the extremely harsh winters.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Until July?
Yeah.
No, thank you.
I think that's like when the ice melt was.
I'm complaining about 50s over here.
So that left sled dogs as the only reliable way to get around. So before those ships left for the winter, you really had to make sure that you had everything you needed or wanted for that long winter and spring and half of summer ahead of you. In the summer of 1924, Nome's only doctor, Curtis Welch, sent a request for more diphtheria antitoxin after he noticed that the units that he had were expired. But when the last ship of the year came and went without any new antitoxin, he crossed his fingers and hoped for the best.
Uh-oh.
Being so isolated might protect them from any outbreaks coming their way, and they had been lucky avoiding diphtheria in previous years. But the 1918 flu still lingered on everyone's minds. I don't know if I mentioned this in our flu episode since it was like 100 years ago.
It was about a year ago.
But this part of the world suffered some of the highest death rates during the flu.
Yeah.
In Nome, 50% of the population of Alaska natives died.
You know, you did mention that.
Okay, I thought so, because it's such an intense, it was such a high mortality rate.
Yeah.
And so, on Christmas Eve 1924, when Dr. Welch heard of a 7-year-old girl who had a very sore throat, he worried. If this was diphtheria, Nome was on its own, with enough expired antitoxin to help just a handful of people. Oof. And in particular, he worried about the thousands of Alaska natives living in the area who had lower resistance to diphtheria.
Oh, no.
A few days later, on December 28th, the girl died, and several more cases of sore throat began popping up.
Welch didn't officially diagnose anyone with diphtheria until mid-January, and by this time, at least 5 children were dead of the illness. And this is in a really small, super isolated town.
Yeah.
So now is the time to panic. He sent out a telegram to the U.S. Public Health Service pleading for antitoxin. Some way, get it to Nome, please. Getting together that much antitoxin wasn't a problem, but the issue was getting it to Nome. By sea was impossible because of ice. By plane was considered too dangerous, but by sled dog was another story.
Oh my God.
This still doesn't sound familiar to you?
No.
Okay.
Wait. Is this a book or something?
Well, it is a book, but it's also a movie.
Is it Balto?
Yeah.
Stop it.
Yes.
This is Balto?
Yes.
Balto is about diphtheria.
Yep.
I had no idea.
That's why I was so thrilled.
Your face is so happy right now. It's like so satisfied.
Oh, I love it. Well, Balto was... So Bloodmobile, who provides all the music for this episode and all of our episodes, is my brother Dan. And
we've blown his cover.
I think we already said that.
Yeah, I know.
He was obsessed with Balto. Oh, like, we had to watch it over and over and over again.
That's
so
adorable.
Yes. I've always loved it. Okay, so...
She's still so happy.
Anyway, so officials decided that they would use a relay of dog sleds to transport the serum the 674 miles, or 1,085 kilometers,
nice,
from Nenana to Nome.
Wow.
Nenana's close to Fairbanks.
Okay.
The heroic efforts of the sled dogs and their handlers were on the front page of every U.S. newspaper.
Oh my God.
And much of the population waited anxiously to see whether the antitoxin would successfully make it to Nome. These handlers, most of whom were Alaska natives, and their dogs had to endure extreme winter conditions. Dogs lost their lives, people lost their fingers, or suffered permanent damage from frostbite. Mm. But in just 5.5 days, so an area of 674 miles.
Of frozen.
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 This is in January. Over 1,000 kilometers in January.
In
mid-January.
Alaska. Uh-huh. Oh my God.
Yeah. The antitoxin arrived in Nome, carried by Gunnar Kossen and his lead dog, Balto.
Balto.
About whom the movie was made. But I want to do my part to clear up a historical misrepresentation about Balto and the serum race. Even though Balto and Kossen were the ones to deliver the serum to Nome, they were only the last ones in a long relay, which involved many more dogs and handlers. Among these is the dog considered the true hero of this story, Togo.
Togo!
And his handler, Leonard Seppala. Togo ran more than 261 miles.
Oh my goodness.
420 kilometers during this relay. And his leg of the relay was 91 miles, 146 kilometers, which was more than twice any other team. He safely led his team through some of the worst conditions and across the treacherous Norton Sound, which is this frozen inlet of the Bering Sea. So over frozen seawater.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But Togo didn't get any of the recognition, or at least not nearly as much, especially right after the serum got there, that Balto received, which, like, there's a statue of Balto in New York City's Central Park. And Seppala, who was the handler, was super salty about this.
Well, yeah, I would be too, because he was with him.
Yeah, I know. The outbreak in Nome was small. Only 6 or 7 children died, and maybe 500 to 100 people were infected with diphtheria. But the numbers could have climbed a lot higher had the serum race not been successful. And maybe Togo will finally get the recognition he deserves, because apparently there's a live-action Disney movie in the works called Togo.
Stop it.
In which Willem Dafoe, everyone's favorite hero,
what?
We'll play Leonard Seppala.
No. Mm-mm. Mm-mm. No. Veto.
Oh, well. We'll see.
Sorry, Will.
I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for that, though.
So I tell this story about Nome and Togo and Balto to underline just how scary this disease was.
Right. People were willing to go to pretty extreme lengths to like protect this tiny little town.
And they were captivated. Like, this was on the cover of every newspaper. A few years after the Nome serum race, a diphtheria vaccine was created using the toxoid, which was the inactivated form of the toxin. And it went into wide use in the 1930s, and the disease really dropped off to where most doctors today have no idea what a diphtheria membrane looks like.
Only in pictures.
Or smells like.
I think that's why we don't, like, it's not in a picture.
Yeah, exactly. We talk, scratch and sniff.
Yeah, we talk a lot about smells of some bacteria specifically that like the bacteria make a smell.
Right.
But with this, my guess is that it's just like a bunch of deadness that is making the smell.
I just want to repeat again what I said about a scratch and sniff book.
Scratch and sniff pseudomembrane.
Scratch and sniff medical textbook.
Oh, grody, dude. No,
that's genius.
I would not buy.
No, but somebody would buy it for you.
Yeah, that's true.
That's basically all I've got. So
that's it?
Yeah.
You're done?
I'm done.
You're like, and then they made a vaccine? Story over?
Well, that's because I think that's where you pick it up. And you tell me about how the anti-vaccine movement might be changing things.
Okay. Let's do it. So just because we invented a vaccine doesn't mean we've pulled a smallpox. This has not been eliminated from the world. It has not been eliminated from the United States. Still exists. But in the United States, it is actually a pretty huge success story. So, for example, in 1921... in the United States, so before there was any kind of vaccine, there were 206,000 cases of diphtheria reported.
That's a lot.
Yeah, there were also over 15,000 deaths.
Oh my.
I know.
Most
poor
children.
Babes. Yeah. But since 1980,
okay,
there have not been any double digit year cases. So no. Double-digit cases. That was a weird way to say it, Aaron.
Fewer than 10.
There you go. And in many years, zero cases in the United States have been reported.
That's great.
It's very great. It's not so across the globe. So the World Health Organization, and I'll actually post this because I don't think I'm the only one who'll find it interesting, has little fact sheets about the number of cases of all of the vaccine preventable diseases, of which diphtheria is one, and how many or what percentage of people are actually vaccinated across the world. So this is aggregated all of the countries of the world, how many actual case reports there have been of all of these diseases.
Okay.
So keep in mind, as always, that, you know, it's just the reported cases. There's a lot of underreporting and many places who might not report it at all, et cetera, et cetera. But the numbers have been generally getting better for the most part. In 1980, worldwide, there were over 97,000 cases of diphtheria reported.
Wait, hold on. 1980. 97,000. Okay.
1990, that number had dropped to 23,000. Holy crap. Way to go, world. Right?
That's because of the vaccine?
I mean, the vaccine has been in use since the, you know, 20s.
But sure, but I mean, like,
vaccination
better
rates,
coverage?
Yeah, they went up from 31% in 1980 worldwide to 88% in 1990.
Whoa.
Yeah. That's for one dose of the vaccine. Okay. So one thing I will say is that the vaccine for diphtheria, it's usually given in combination with tetanus and pertussis. So you might hear people say DTP or Tdap or DTAP. There's a lot of different versions of it. Yeah. So these are all different combinations of diphtheria, toxoid, which is just an inactivated toxin, tetanus toxoid, inactivated tetanus toxin, and pertussis, either the whole bacterium or parts of the bacterium. Mm-hmm. And because in all of those cases, you're giving a killed toxin and not a live bacterium, your immune system only mounts a partial response to it. Mm. So one dose is not enough to actually give you full immunity. So in the US, children actually get 5 doses of DTaP.
Okay.
Up until they're about 6 years old. And then after that, it's recommended that you get a booster every 10 years. Worldwide, one of the biggest challenges is making sure that people get all of the recommended doses of vaccines like the DTP vaccine, because giving just one is good, but giving 3 or 4 or 5 is a lot better.
Right.
So globally, the rates of the rates of children who have received at least one DTP vaccine is pretty high, but the rates that have received at least 3, which is what's recommended by WHO, is a bit lower. Okay, so where were we? We were in 1990, right? With 23,000 cases worldwide.
Yeah.
Cut to 2000, still doing great, only 11,000 cases.
All right.
2013, 4,000.
What?
2014, 7,000? Must have been a fluke. 2015, okay. Back down to 4,000. Awesome.
What's up?
2016, 7,000?
Okay.
2017, 8,800.
Okay, not a fluke.
Not a fluke. It's not great. It's hard to say for sure what the cause of this is, because globally, vaccination rates, at least reported vaccination rates, have not changed. Globally. That is not true in the United States. But what it basically means is that at least over the last 5 years, we haven't really gotten better, right? We haven't made huge strides in the last few years in terms of actually reducing the burden of diphtheria. And it definitely still exists. And something that I thought was really interesting that I definitely didn't realize is that if you were to like randomly screen a whole bunch of people's noses or nasopharynxes in the United States, even in areas where you have relatively high, or I suppose what someone would think would sound relatively high, vaccination rates, like say 80%, which sounds high, but for vaccination rates is actually not good.
Yeah.
You can find a lot of people colonized with diphtheria in the United States. So this bacteria still exists here. So even though we haven't had a case of diphtheria in the United States since in 2012, we had one. And before that, it was 2003.
Okay.
We had one. So even though the case rates of diphtheria in the United States are very low, that doesn't mean that it's not here, right?
Right.
The R-naught of diphtheria is 6 to 7, which is really high.
It's really high.
It's second to like measles, which we haven't.
14.
How have we not talked about measles yet?
Because because there are tons of diseases.
Okay, but we need to put that on our list.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's really high. So what that basically means is that, yeah, for every one infected kid, you could potentially infect 6 or 7 more kids.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. It's
and scary.
It's really scary, especially also because the Tdap, Dtap, whatever you call it, vaccine, I mean, they're different vaccines, but whichever vaccine it is recommended for pregnant women. And that's because since you have this waning immunity, you want to make sure that a pregnant woman is immune so that she passes on those immunoglobulins to her baby. Mm. Because babies don't actually get vaccinated until 2 months old. So for those first 2 months, they're super, super susceptible.
Gotcha.
If you don't if a woman maybe doesn't have access to prenatal care or doesn't have health insurance or things like that, and doesn't get that, then you can potentially have babies that are completely susceptible. And so that's why this whole vaccination thing becomes really important, is that it's not just about like your individual risk. It's about the fact that there are a lot of people in the community that either are too young to be vaccinated, are very old, so they just don't have a good immune system left,
right.
Are already immunocompromised, whether it's from something like HIV or leukemia or other immune disorders, so they can't be vaccinated.
Right.
And so those are the people who are most at risk when you have low levels of vaccination in a population.
It just, it blows my mind after reading about this disease and hearing about this disease from you and the progression of disease that there are people who choose to go, nah, I'm just going to take my chances.
I think the thing is, though, that we don't hear about this. It's not on the front page of our newspapers because one kid has gotten it since 2012.
In the U.S.
But it's also, it's not in everyone's face and it's not every day and it's not everywhere. So it's very easy individually to say that problem is elsewhere and it's not going to affect me. I mean, I think that's why it's just about making sure that people are aware that these diseases still do exist. And that's why these vaccines are important.
It's scary. The disease itself is scary.
Right.
And what's the scariest thing is that there are people who can be protected against it and can, by doing that, protect other people against it. And
right.
they are choosing to not do that.
Yeah.
That's the scariest part to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's scary. It is scary.
Well.
I wish I had some happy note. I mean, worldwide vaccine coverage is about 85 to 90%, which is great. Yeah, that's good old diphtheria. Who knew, quite honestly? I didn't know most of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, there's. I feel like there's a lot more to diphtheria than I knew was going to be out there, and I'm really glad that we covered this.
Yeah.
And
thanks, Balto. I mean, Togo.
Thanks, Togo.
Sources?
Yeah, I have a few.
Okay.
So the story of Balto and the whole sled dog race and the race for the antitoxin, it's called The Cruelest Miles, and it's by Gay and Lainey Salisbury. And I also use the Cambridge World History of Human Disease, The Epidemic Streets by Anne Hardy, and a couple of papers. But I also wanted to plug, I read this book in middle school, and when it came up in the searches, I was like, I definitely recognize that cover. And it's called Running Out of Time by Margaret Peterson Haddix. It is quite dark. So no wonder I loved it. Anyway, you should definitely read it, Running Out of Time.
I want to read it.
Yeah, you should.
Also, we'll definitely add that book to our Goodreads list, which, as a reminder, you can find all of our sources, including all of the articles and books that we read for each episode, as well as links to our Goodreads list on our website, thispodcastwillkillyou.com.
Thank you, as always, to Bloodmobile, also Balta's number one fan.
Yep.
And to all of you for listening.
Also, don't forget, if you aren't already, to subscribe to all of our social media situations. Rate, review, subscribe on iTunes.
Well, until next time, wash your hands.
You filthy animals.